Welcome to Sabbath School. We're so glad that you're with us. You've already discovered that we have half a classroom this morning, but that's all right. We'll do all right in this space unless we grow too much. We are introducing a new quarter today. This will be the beginning of the third quarter, which is entitled The Refiner's Fire, and we'll talk about fourth quarter. I'm sorry. The Refiner's Fire. This is lesson one, called The Shepherd's Crucible. And we'll be talking about the issue of persecution, hardship, and so forth in the Christian church and what role it plays in the Christian's life. So let's begin with a word of prayer. Our loving Father, as always, we come to ask your presence to be with us, the blessings of the Holy Spirit, the guidance that we need as we think about these scriptures and about what they may mean to us. May we gather the message that you have for us as our prayer in Jesus' name. Amen. One of the biggest questions that's always raised, and the offering will be coming around, but one of the biggest questions that is always raised when Christians suffer persecution or suffer difficulties is God still around? Is God a part of this? Why would God ever lead me into this kind of difficulty? And so our series this quarter begins with Psalm 23. Now maybe you hadn't thought of Psalm 23 as talking about Christians facing hard times, but you do remember that there's some passages toward the end of Psalm 23 that talk about going through the valley of the shadow of death and so forth. So that's what we're going to focus on this morning. We're going to ask some larger questions. And I'm going to ask you to try to think outside the box this morning. Now I know this is Sabbath morning, this is not your work week, but please, if you possibly can, stretch your brains, because I'm going to ask you some tough questions. And I don't pretend to have the answers. I have some ideas about some of these, but these are questions that the church, I think, should have been asking itself for a long time. And just to sort of get us warmed up, ask this question: when hard times come, who's responsible? Do we bring them on ourselves? Is it always the devil's fault? Does God ever bring us into testing? There it is, Matthew 6, verse 13, right at the top of the screen. Can you all see it? Okay? It's right here. Do not bring us to hard testing. So Jesus told us to pray that prayer. Do not bring us to hard testing. Is that suggesting that if we don't pray that, God will bring us to hard testing? You don't think so? We've got a couple of mics there, so don't. I assume we got our mics ready. Yeah, we got mics ready. So, why do you suppose God would ask us to pray like that? Anybody? Everybody's frightened of the new close quarters here, I guess. John? John will get us started. Why would God ask us to pray like that if he doesn't ever lead us to testing?
Well, maybe it's because Satan is praying to bring hard times mm-hmm. on us. I think Satan understands that he is not in control of the universe, that the Creator is, mm-hmm. and he only allows Satan to do as much as Satan asks him to do, like in the case of Job. He says, let me at him. And God said, okay, but just don't step over the line. Okay. And I think that's maybe why he says, bring us not into hard times or keep us from hard times.
Okay, now it's time for you to really put on your thinking caps. I'm going to read some words from Ellen White. These should be quite familiar. I hope they are to all of you. But they're challenging. These are challenging words. Look at this. God never leads us. And I ask the question at the top, do you really believe this? Do you really agree with this? God never leads his children otherwise than they would choose to be led if they could see the end from the beginning and discern the glory of the purpose which they are fulfilling as co-workers with him. Not Enoch, who was translated to heaven. I mean, what better reward could you possibly ask than that? Not Elijah, who was ascended in a chariot of fire, was greater or more honored than John the Baptist, who perished alone in the dungeon. Unto you is given in the behalf of Christ not only to believe on him, but also to suffer for his sake, Philippians 1:29. And of all the gifts that heaven can bestow upon men, and that's you ladies too, fellowship with Christ in his sufferings is the most weighty trust and the highest honor. Do you believe that? Now, we all are supposed to be saying this because we're good, obedient Seventh-day Adventists, you know. Gordon is going to help me. We got another mic over here.
I have a question, actually. Does that mean that everything that happens is God's will?
Okay, that's one of the big questions.
Or does it mean once something bad happens that God leads us in the best way that he can after our bad choices before that?
Okay. Bob.
I think the key words here, it says if they could see the end from the beginning.
So in other words, we can get into all kinds of difficulties because here on this earth, we can't see the end from the beginning. So this verse is nice to know, but it really has no meaning for us until we get to heaven.
No, because if we allow God to lead us, and he will show us where he's leading us. Because John the Baptist we talk about here, he willfully did what he had to do. He accepted that was part of God's plan.
Did he have to confront Herod?
Well, yeah, because he was following God's leading.
Okay. We've got two more hands up here. Carrie?
For me, the text that comes to mind here is, ye are not tempted above that which ye are able, which to me infers that there's some kind of control. I would like to think it was God and not the other party.
Alda.
We have the example of the children of Israel. He led them straight to the land of Canaan, and they refused to enter at the time, so they had to go around for another 40 years. And we think, well, why did God take them for 40 years instead of, remember, he took them straight the first time?
Yeah, how about that? Okay, there's a kicker in this quotation that we sometimes sort of slide over. Jerry?
Well, it just seems to me one of the things in this is that to keep in mind that this life and even our salvation is not the only focus or the only issue.
Mm-hmm.
There is a larger purpose. I mean, in the book of Job, you don't really get the answer until chapter 42.
Yep.
We kind of want answers in chapters 1 and 2,
but
we don't get that. I mean, we're part of a larger thing going on here.
Okay, hang on to the mic. Don't let it go. So I want to ask you a question. The question really is, and we're going to go on here, 3, 4, and 5. Maybe I should go ahead and read these. Look at 3, 4, and 5 in your handout. Do you believe that God directly guides you in your personal life? How does he do that? Does God ever lead us into dangerous places? What about the stories of Daniel and his three friends? Is it consistently true that trials lead to purification and righteousness? Does God cause trials or does he only allow them? And so in light of that, I want you to keep that in mind. You see, it says God never leads his children. Now, it's been suggested, well, we'll know the answer when we get into the better land, but leading suggests someone's out there and you can see where to go, right? So my question back to you is, are we always going the way God leads? Or is the real problem here that sometimes we don't follow God's leading? What do you think?
Well, I think that varies by individual. I think you look at the scriptural record. I mean, some were led much more closely than others. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's quite an individual basis. Maybe even by God's election or by our choice.
Okay. We've got. Go ahead, John.
I think he causes everything. He is the cause of everything, even of Satan being the way he is because of the choices he made. And I want to say that I believe we can see the end from the beginning by reading the last three chapters of Revelation. We can see the end from the beginning in the last three chapters of the Bible.
Okay. Larry? Go ahead.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I have a question right here. It says God never leads us in otherwise, I mean, his children otherwise than they would choose to be led. That means whatever I choose?
No, what that means is, let me try to put it in my words. What that means, as Bob already suggested, is when we finally get to the end and we look back, we will say, yes, God, the way you led me, not necessarily the way I followed, because sometimes I don't always follow, but if we're really following God's guidance and we follow him step by step, then we'll be able to look back and say, okay, yes, God, when you led me into that difficult time or that situation or this or that, at the time I thought that was awful. But in actual fact, I now see, now that I see the whole picture from this perspective of eternity, I now see that that was the right thing. And so we will say, God, you did it right. I agree with you now. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean we're going to agree with him. It looks like it now.
Like one day you choose to go this way or that way, and it's your own choosing, really.
Okay, well, that's the question, you see. Do we get into difficulty because God leads us into difficulty, or do we get into difficulty because we stop following his leading and we go our own way? That's the big, big question here. Okay, Larry.
Yeah, I think that, you know, God, values our freedom of choice, and he's always beside us, so that we're following him, and I kind of liken it to our GPS in our car, that at the very beginning, we'll put in the destination, and GPS says, this is the most direct route. Mm-hmm. And if we take a left turn or right turn that's not in the plan, and then the GPS will say, recalculating route, yeah. And now I'll take you from where you are now.
Yeah.
And if we keep going off path, God is still with us. He says, okay, recalculating. Okay, you made this choice, and so now this is the direction to the kingdom. If you make another bad choice, and he says, no, now this is the new direction to get to where you want to go. So I think that the allowing us to make our choices, but God promising to be with us, not necessarily leading us, but always maybe plan B, plan C, plan D, as we make, you know, potentially inappropriate choices, that he can readjust his plan for us personally and say, okay, now this is your new path to the kingdom.
Okay. I'm chuckle as I hear you talk about that, because we have all these sophisticated devices. My friends who in Africa would say, what in the world are you talking about? Gordon.
Speaking of recalculating the path or giving a specific example, we have the example of Paul near the end of making his final trip to Jerusalem. And he was told by prophets, he was told by church members, he was told by many people, don't go to Jerusalem. He went to Jerusalem anyway. Ellen White seems to suggest that was not God's leading to go to Jerusalem. And yet God was with Paul after that.
Okay, that's a really interesting question. I wish we had more time to pursue, but anyway, go ahead. We got Judy back here. I think she's the next one with them.
There's Brian over here.
Brian, I'm sorry.
Yeah, part of the recalculating obviously deals with multiple forces on the individual involved. If God is leading, the individual has free will and can choose to follow closely or further to the right or to the left.
the devil obviously has some impact, as well as every other free moral agent around that, you know, interacts with that person. So there's a lot of recalculating going on. But I think in the best way, this kind of a statement is a promise. You know, if you try hard to really tie your life to God and follow, when anything happens, you can still find some solace in from the beginning and just trusting, as Job did in a way, and move on.
Okay, Judy?
Speaking about God's guidance, the Torah says how God led the Israelites via the Red Sea. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the night before and the next morning, there was a vastly different perception of God had a clue what he was doing. Mm-hmm. But that event marked the basis of glory and hosannas for millennia thereafter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. God leads you into a dead end, and you think this is the end, we're all going to die, and what's the next thing you know? A couple of days later, or a day and a half later, or overnight, basically, this is the greatest thing that's ever happened to you, you know? So that's a very good illustration of how God clearly was leading them. I mean, there was the cloud, you know? And there was Moses being guided. But yet, from a human perspective, it looked like a terrible mistake, didn't it? So that's a good example. Bob.
Well, I think there's different types of leading here, too. I think God leads us as individuals toward salvation. Mm-hmm. God leads us to others to reach them for their salvation. Mm-hmm. And God leads us to the world to proclaim his character. So you've got different roles that go on in leading us in different directions. That we can refuse to go out and do any work for God, but he's still going to lead us as an individual. Mm-hmm. So, but Satan's in there to twist this picture all around. And so that's, I think this GPS thing, it's a good analogy, is that God is taking us from where we are to him.
Yeah.
And we all are in a different place.
Okay. Got two hands at the back there, Carrie.
I'm wondering if we don't need to tie this into accountability. I'm looking around me here. All of us here, I think it is fair to say, have had more opportunities than millions and millions of people in this world. Look at these poor devils in the Bangladesh and people in Peru that just got clubbed with a sliding mountain.
Yeah.
Where do you draw the line? I'm sure we all look back. I know I have, and you realize you should have taken a different turn maybe. Personal choice comes into it a lot, and I think it's tied into God's leading too.
Yeah. Okay. Very much so. Jerry.
Sorry for my wife.
Okay. Thought you were going to try to put us all to sleep there. Is that a lullaby? Or?
The GPS is a nice illustration. That young lady in my GPS has a clearer signal from the satellite than I do from God many times.
Yeah. And how about that? I mean, the thing is this, the GPS, you know, there it is on the screen, and the voice is talking to you. I mean, you know, why doesn't God lead us like that?
Well, we got so much static from our side. I mean, and your question, does God guide the church? Oh, man, yes, he does, but there's so much humanity interference in that that. And I realize that the more and more I associate in administrative levels of the church.
This last week, I had the interesting experience of chatting with someone I didn't expect to be talking to. Maybe that'll prevent you from trying to trace it. But this particular person had just been chosen to be chairman of a major committee in the church. And this person said to me, I'm not sure this was a good idea. He said to me, the difficulty with dealing with other aspects of the church, other entities in the church, is there's an awful lot of egos around. And he went on to say some more things. I won't go into detail because you might try to identify who I'm talking about. But is that the way God guides us through a jungle of egos? Okay, I hear mumblings, but only John is brave enough to raise his hand. Go ahead.
Well, do we have any counsel from Ellen White on just how the General Conference cooperates with God or fails to?
But I have on my computer at home, and it's probably best that I don't have it with me right now. A very interesting set of quotations put together by someone some years ago, starting out by saying that the General Conference in session is God's ordained voice on this earth, and it goes down and chronologically until you get to the bottom, it says we may still have to be in this world of sin and troubles for many more years because the brethren are not doing what they're supposed to. That's not the progression in the direction we'd like to go.
Besides that, I would like to ask, is God causing the tsunamis and the earthquakes and the hurricanes and the tornadoes and the hot spots?
You should have been with us on our geology trip. We learned about those kind of things.
Did you find God up there on the geology trip?
Sure, of course. We learned about the tsunamis and the earthquakes and the layers and all that kind of stuff. Sure, exactly. Well, the interesting thing is if you go back and you trace the background, since we're supposed to be focusing on Psalm 23, if you look at Education, page 164, Ellen White says David wrote this psalm when he was very young and still tending sheep. Psalm 23. Yeah, Psalm 23. He wrote this psalm when he was still very young and tending sheep. So this was a psalm that he wrote out of his experiences taking care of sheep on the hills of Palestine. Does that help us to understand it? Well, it's something to keep in mind. We know that throughout Scripture there are many examples of the shepherd motif, if you will. Just look at some. Isaiah 40, verse 11, he gathers lambs up in his arms. Jeremiah 23, verses 3 and 4, he rounds up the sheep and cares for every one of them. Ezekiel 34, 12, no matter how far they are scattered, if they will come back to him, he will bring them back to himself. John 10, 14 to 16, he not only has this flock, he has other flocks. So that not all of God's children belong to the same group, if you will. And finally, 1 Peter 2:25, although we may have been lost, God brings us back and cares for us. And of course, the passage that the parable that we're all very familiar with is the lost sheep there in Luke 15. No, not 15. Anyway, somewhere about there. And so I come back to my main question. If you look back over the history of the church, when has it prospered the most, in times of adversity or in times of prosperity? So if we're talking about a time, if we're talking here, we come here and we discuss things and we say, you know, we really wish God would get on with it and finish up the gospel here and bring this whole thing to a conclusion. Does that mean that we should be praying for adversity? Hold on just a minute. I guess Don's got a mic. Go ahead.
I just wanted to make a comment about your previous thought there about David and herding sheep. You recognize usually every great leader for God. God took out of the culture and civilization many times and, you know, like Moses and in 40 years, mm-hmm. taking care of lambs. Even Saul and then Paul spent 2.5 years in Arabia. I don't know if he's making tents there, but mm-hmm. anyhow, I think it's important to remember that to have a time to listen to the still small voice. Mm-hmm. In essence, that's what it says to me.
Okay. Brian?
Do you think the problems that the church is having with the General Conference and the rest of the body is because...
The church is having trouble with the General Conference? Well, That's good. Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Any way you put it, because God essentially...
I'm sorry, I just...
...the dumbest animal for us to be compared to? I mean, is there anything more...
You didn't have to put it like that.
I mean...
What is it about sheep that makes them like us?
They don't think.
What? Okay. Yeah, okay. Oh. All right. Go ahead.
I was going on to another point.
Oh, okay.
You asked the question.
You didn't want to discuss about the condition of sheep.
I was already on church prospering.
Okay, go ahead.
You talked about when does the church prosper. I want to know how you define prospering.
Well, and if you'll allow me here just a minute, I did a little research on this, see if I can find... Oh, yeah, right there, number 11.
Look, church numbers... Is it baptisms?
Well, hold on. I'll let you draw your own conclusions here just a second. Look back over the recorded history of the church and God's people. Have God's people generally done better spiritually in prosperous times or in difficult times? Explain your answer. And that's what I'm asking you to do. Tertullian, who lived, about 150 to 250 or something like that, A.D., I mean, we're talking way back now, said, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. You must have heard that expression before. When things are easy and prosperous economically, do we sometimes feel tempted to believe that we can manage on our own without God's help? Yeah.
Is it necessary for trials and tribulations for the development of character? Because if you go on that premise, how would Adam and Eve have developed character before they fell?
Okay, fair. Good question. Very good question. I've got two more people with hands. Maybe you can help me. Go ahead, John, and then Brian.
Your question was, should we pray for adversity, was it? Was that the question? No, I think we should not pray for adversity, but I think we should pray for God to lead us into what we should be doing, and when the adversity comes, ask Him to take it away.
Okay. Okay. But I mean, let's be honest. It's real easy for us to pray for the things we want and try to skip over the bad things. But isn't it, if we're honest, don't we recognize that there's going to be a lot of really, at least a significant amount of really tough times before He comes again? So if we're praying for Jesus to come back, what are we really praying for? We're praying for the tough times, right?
Well, no.
Yes and no. Okay, Ryan.
The church has always done better under rough circumstances.
Why? That's my big question today. Why does the church do better under tough times?
Well, Bob. There's a direct connection between prayer and success.
Okay, so what you're saying is that under tough times, the church does more praying.
Exactly. I mean, when the children of Israel were off in Babylon or somewhere else, and they were praying, please help us, you know, God answered their prayer. I mean, there's a lot more petition, a lot more prayer going on. Look at Daniel's prayer. That wasn't under the best of circumstances.
He was prime minister. I wouldn't say that's too tough.
Oh, but the best prayers are always forged under hard times.
Okay. Bob.
I think we got to remember there's another factor, a big factor involved in this whole situation is if it was just up to God, we wouldn't need to do all this stuff. But we've got this guy called Satan that's in there. And the closer we get to God, the more concerned Satan gets, and he doesn't want us to go to God. He wants us to go to him. So he's going to do whatever he can to pull us away from God, to tempt us in his way.
Which leads us to the next big question. Can you tell for sure when you're being led by God? Now we've got a whole bunch of experts here in the room. Yes, you can help us? We got a hand right down here. Oh, okay. Up there as well. Go ahead.
I was going to go back to Brian's comment. I've watched several churches fall and gone through severe adversity. Mm-hmm. A lot of those people no longer go to church. Mm-hmm. Those who weren't strong enough to go through the fire fell by the way, thus making us a stronger church that was left.
Okay. So...
What
let me extend your question, your comment a little bit. Is God not letting us face? I mean, is there anybody here that has a question about the fact that God would like to come tomorrow if he could? I mean, does anyone have a question about that? Jesus has been waiting for us. He's been waiting for 2,000 years. He wants to come back every day. He wishes he could come back. Okay? I don't hope nobody here has any question about that. Okay. In light of that, why doesn't he? And of course, we've talked about the problems within the church. We've talked about the problems within us. But her suggestion is, you know, adversity comes to a given church, for example, and the place falls apart. Would that happen to the whole church if God allowed adversity to come to the whole church? Okay.
You know, Dante paints Satan as being kind of God's little angel who does all the bad stuff for Jesus, for God, and then at the end he runs up to heaven as his little servant. And I think it's important that we don't get confused with that we don't need God to be necessarily like being the person behind the trials and temptations. We have these other forces that are working against us. And I think to me it seems like when Adam and Eve fell, God was kind of became their life support and had to protect them from things that they weren't ready for yet. And I think it's the same with us, that we're not ready for a lot of the trials and temptations that are out there that Satan would like to destroy us with. And so God says, in order to like let you grow, I'm protecting you, but as you become stronger in me, I can give you more of your free will and more of the liberty, because you can now deal with it as you become stronger. And I think we don't need God to be leading us into temptation. We do enough of that ourselves, and we have enough of the other side working against us. But I think in the same way, God says, you're not strong enough to be able to withhold that. I'm going to step back so you can show yourself as being with me and being as you can withstand them, kind of.
Okay, your question leads me to another big part of this whole thing that I wanted to ask. It's very important. Thank you very much. If God is leading us, and let's suppose that we're doing our very best as human beings to follow his guidance, would God allow Satan to harass us at the same time we are doing our best to follow God's guidance?
Well,
don't give me "it depends."
Well, it goes along with the freedom of choice and the freedom of will that God has to allow us.
Uh-huh.
He can't just like protect us from everything, because everyone having their free choice means that some people are going to make the wrong choice.
Okay.
Which affects us. And I think, yes, God is always leading us, but there are always, we're separated from God. So there's always, even though he's still leading us, there's still things we're going to be going through.
And I agree with that completely. I have no question about that. The question is, if we believe that God is leading us and we are doing our very best from a human standpoint to follow his guidance, in other words, as far as we know, we're keeping that path open between us and God, and we're saying, God, you want me to go here? Okay, I'm going there. You want me to go here? I'm going there. Whatever he does, we're trying to follow him. Can Satan harass us while God is leading us?
Yeah.
You think so? Which examples can you give? Job and Jesus would be perfect examples, and John the Baptist would be a perfect example, right? So we... Yeah. Gary.
I think God gives Satan a certain license, and in a simple answer to what you just asked, I would say yes. Why do I say that? I remember an Adventist minister who was not originally an Adventist, and early in his career, unfortunately, he died of cancer, but he had been a spirit medium. He converted to Adventism, and he went to Avondale College, and I asked him, said, how did you get on? He said, they used to throw me out of my bed onto the floor. I would hear voices in my ears. That's Satan getting at you. Mm-hmm. The key there was, when he was a spirit medium, he didn't know any better. We do.
Mm-hmm.
You give the devil an open door, he's going to be there. And getting back to your other question on adversity, I think it does the church good, because
we get, well, hopefully we will, but certainly earlier people, they get focused. The inconsequentials go out.
Okay. We still got, okay, go ahead. Yes.
Yeah, I noticed that some people have more problems with Satan than others.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I know one lady that had so much problems. I mean, she was very concentrated. You know, she was doing God's will and everything.
But she was having so much
problems with Satan.
Yeah.
Many, many problems.
Do you think that if we're really trying to follow God, we'll have more problems with Satan? Or is it the people who are sort of lackadaisical, they're not being really careful about following God, that have troubles with Satan?
Yeah, they don't realize Satan is in their lives, so they don't really care. I mean, they don't really notice it.
So,
but the people that are more closely to God, they seem to notice it more than others.
You think it's just the fact that they notice it, or do you think Satan is really working harder on them?
Well, he could be working harder on them.
Well, and look at example. Let's all pretend for just a moment that we're on Satan's side. Okay, we're going to think Satan, along with Satan here and his plan.
Yeah.
Okay, if you are the devil and you know, here's a Satan who's a wise. I mean, he's got a huge intelligence. Okay, he knows that if God ever manages to get together a significant group of people that are following him, no matter what, Satan's got the curtains. I mean, that's the end for him. He's dead. Okay? It's all over for him if he gets enough of these people together. So as he sees you and some others in this room and people all over the world gradually becoming more and more concerned about their relationship to God and their commitment to God and really following God very faithfully, what does that mean to him?
He's got to work harder.
Exactly. He better work really hard because, I mean, this is a life and death matter with him. It's life and death. Norm.
In the hereafter, as God leads us, I would expect at that point in time we'd be happy with all the things that he leads us into. But this is a different time. This is a different age. This is a time in which sin has its opportunity to demonstrate how vile and awful it is. Mm-hmm. And just as God led Jesus through the Calvary experience, we will have opportunity to share. It was Job who was so miserable, who was so faithful to God. And so when bad things happen to good people, God is demonstrating how awful sin is so that we won't have to go through it again.
Yep.
So we can't expect an easy time during this period of our existence.
Since we're supposed to be talking about Psalm 23, let's just read a couple of verses and then let's ask some questions about it. There's a whole six verses. Let me read the whole thing. I'm reading here from the Good News Bible. The Lord is my shepherd. I have everything I need. He lets me rest in fields of green grass and leads me to quiet pools of fresh water. Now, there's nothing a sheep could ask for more than that. I mean, you know, how could it be any better than that? He gives me new strength. He guides me in the right paths. And we're going to come back and ask about these right paths in just a moment. As he has promised, even if I go through the deepest darkness, I will not be afraid, Lord, for you are with me. Your shepherd's rod and staff protect me. You prepare a banquet for me where all my enemies can see me. Is that where you prefer to take your meals? You welcome me as an honored guest and fill my cup to the brim. I know that your goodness and love will be with me all my life, and your house will be my home as long as I live. And so, let's ask, Brian, go ahead. Oh, go ahead. You're first.
Yes, I'm sorry, brothers. I don't think I will speak. I speak fluent English.
It's all right.
As,
you're doing just
you
fine.
Do. But I would like to make a comment on the question, have God's people generally done better spiritually in prosperous times or in difficult times? I would like to start with difficult times. And I was born in a former communist country, And I grew up in a very faithful Seventh-day Adventist church, not a very large one, but a very small one. At that time, most of the churches were closed, I mean, shut down by the communist regime. And the churches were full of people, crowded. At 8 or 8:30, we began with a prayer meeting, and the seats were taken. If you dare to come at 9 or 9:30, you risked to stay outside. We had to go through the years of heavy persecutions, losing jobs. I lost my jobs twice, working in civil constructions, being in charge with lots of responsibilities. But if you didn't conform with their requirements, with their atheistic conditions, or if you didn't come to the workplace and work on Saturday, it was very, very dangerous. Yeah. And there was no welfare or unemployment benefits. Yeah. It was your problem between you and God. So then the years, I mean, lots of our youth had been taken to the military service. It was not optional, it was mandatory, and beaten to death, almost left without any tooth in their mouth. But the faith was stronger, and the spirituality was much, much better. The higher the persecution, the heavier the persecution, the higher the flames of faith were there. Yeah. Now, after the revolution, the situation has been changed. It's whatever we have here, it's there. We built churches, not five churches in the capital. Churches after churches, fancy churches. And they are empty.
Yeah.
People don't show any interest in going to church, in serving God. There is no drawing line between the church and the world. Whatever you see in the world, if it's even worse in the church than outside in the world. And no one cares. All they care is about money, not about your communication, your relationship between God and yourself. So is it better for people to be in prosperous times? I don't know. That's up to each individual. I think from my past experience, and I've been living in this country for almost 17 years, I think that it is better to go to trials than dealing with so much liberty. What do you do with liberty? Too much freedom without God is killing us.
Yeah. Okay. Good. She'll take it. Yeah, thank you very much. I would like to second that. My wife and I had the privilege of visiting Beijing, China, not too long ago. It's still a proclaimed communist country. And we had to go through quite a process to even find out where the Adventist, the church was. It's not an Adventist church, but it's a church that the Adventists are allowed to use on Sabbath. And when you show up at that church, we arrive, like you said, a half an hour early. And they escort you in your seats because there cannot be a single seat left. Every single seat is full. There's a video camera relay to another room. That room is full. And if you don't show up on time, you get to stand outside. See? Why is that? Jim?
I was just reading some figures this week. They said that on the order of 10,000 a day are becoming Christians in China.
Yeah.
And in India, I've heard over the last couple of years about the persecution.
Phenomenal.
If you change religions, there's a law against changing religions, and so Christianity and Adventism is just growing leaps and bounds. So
yeah.
I think it's something.
But there's a very interesting phenomenon going on in India that we need to be aware of in this respect. The church in India, our church in India has never had it like they have it right now. The place is exploding in terms of membership. But guess who's joining the Adventist church?
Non-Christians.
Can anyone guess?
Non-Christians?
Well, non-Christians. A lot of non-Christians. But what kind of people are they? The lowest caste, the untouchables, are the ones who are joining the church. It's not the people who are answering your telephone when you call whatever and ask for some guidance. It's not the people who are middle class and upper class, the people who are doing well. Those aren't the people who are joining the Adventist church. The people who are joining the Adventist church are the untouchables. Why is that? Why do you think? You know, the Adventist church, I don't know how many of you have heard this. The Adventist church has been called a chimney. You ever heard it called a chimney? Social people, sociologists have called the Adventist church a chimney. We take people in at the lowest levels and we send them out to the roof. We bring them in, they struggle, they join the church, they're on fire, etc., as you suggested, and we educate them, we give them all the advantages and so forth, and when they get all those things, they leave. It's a chimney. You come in at the bottom, you leave at the top. Don.
As to why the delay, I remember what Graham Maxwell used to say. We might have a better mansion. Who wants to go to heaven? We might have a better mansion here. And besides, the food, it's kind of plain stuff.
Yes, Bob.
When you were asking the question, does God allow the trials when we follow Him? And I think we came to the conclusion that yes, He does. The next question is why? If we're following Him, why do we need to go through trials? Mm-hmm. Is He preparing us for something ahead? Or sometimes does those trials draw us closer to Him?
Well, shall I take you back to the top up here again? Of all of His gifts, all the gifts that heaven can bestow upon men, fellowship with Christ in His sufferings is the most weighty trust and the highest honor. And then next quote, not without a purpose does God send trial to His children. He subjects them to discipline, to humble them, to lead them, through trial and affliction to see their weakness and draw near to Him. That's Higher Places, page 267, compare Patriarchs and Prophets, 578, says something similar. But look, come down here and, well, I want to do it a couple of things. There's some things we do need to be sure about. Look at number 12 in your handout. What are these paths of right or paths of righteousness here? What is right about them? I mean, if God is leading us through the shadow of death and through these dark valleys, etc., how can you call that a path of right? Well, there's several things that we need to notice. One, these paths always lead to a perfect destination. That's God's home. No matter where it's going, if we knew for sure that this path was leading us to heaven, which path would we be afraid to take? I've said to people, and I've asked this question in this class before, if God said to you, okay, would you be willing to die today if I guarantee you that you'll go straight to heaven? How would we have a problem? Number two, if we follow God's will, those paths will always keep us close to Him. Now, that doesn't mean we're not going to have any difficulties, but that's the idea. He's the shepherd, we're the sheep. If we follow His paths, we should be close to Him. If we're a faithful sheep, the shepherd will teach us to be like Him. And four, if we follow God's paths, He will provide opportunities for us to witness, even to our enemies. And then, since I want to focus on our main theme, I'm going to read you two more quotations that I want you to think about very serious. Those who are finally victorious, this is number 24 in your handout, as you can see. Those who are finally victorious will have seasons of terrible perplexity and trial in their religious life. Does this mean that God is not leading them? No, doesn't. But they must not cast away their confidence, for this is a part of their discipline in the school of Christ, and it is essential in order that all dross may be purged away. Do any of us have dross that needs to be purged? Is it our bank account? Is it our nice... What is the dross? Pride, selfishness, covetous. Anything that would take our mind off of Christ? That's a good answer. Well, okay. He needs to purge away this dross. The servant of God must endure with fortitude the attacks of the enemy. Presumably, it says, it's the servant of God. God is leading us. But what's happening as God is leading us? The devil's in there. He's batting away, right? His grievous taunts and the servant of God must endure with fortitude the attacks of the enemy, his grievous taunts, and must overcome the obstacles which Satan will place in his way. Satan will seek to discourage the followers of Christ so that they may not pray or study the scriptures. And he will throw his hateful shadow athwart the path to hide Jesus from the view, to shut away the vision of his love and the glories of the heavenly inheritance. It is his delight, this is still talking about Satan, it is his delight to cause the children of God to go shrinkingly, tremblingly, and painfully along under continual doubt. What kind of witnesses are we for God if this is the kind of life we're living? He seeks to make the pathway as sorrowful as possible. But if you keep looking up, not down at your difficulties, you will not faint in the way. You will soon see Jesus reaching his hand to help you, and you will only have to give him your hand in simple confidence and let him lead you. As you become trustful, you will become hopeful. And then this last quotation, Messages to the Young People, page 63. It was originally in Review and Herald, April 8, 1890. Christ, and this is the Sons and Daughters of God, page 198. Christ has given us no assurance that to attain perfection of character is an easy matter. It is a conflict, a battle, and a march, day by day. It is through much tribulation that we enter the kingdom of heaven. In order to share with Christ in his glory, we must share in his suffering. He has overcome for us. Shall we then be timid and cowardly because of the trials that we meet as we advance? Okay, and then my last question, which I hope is a sort of summary of what we've talked about this morning. Why is it necessary for us to share in Christ's sufferings? Why is that necessary? John, here's the mic coming.
So that we can become like him.
We need the sufferings in order to become like him.
Yes, but I have another question.
Okay.
That I've been wanting to ask. When Abraham followed God's voice up to the
Mount Moriah,
and got everything ready for the sacrifice and so forth, do you think that Satan would have liked to have had him carry out the sacrifice? And if so, what do you think God would have done with Abraham if he had actually... He did sacrifice his son, we're told, but he didn't kill him.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think would have happened if Satan had had his way and Abraham had killed Isaac right there? There wouldn't be any Jacob. There wouldn't be any children of Israel and so forth.
Abraham thought that through, and he said, I am certain. This is before he did it. Ellen White talks about this. Hebrews 12 talks about this. He said, I am certain that even if he dies, God will raise him back. I mean, God has promised that through this son, I will receive, you know, I will have these multitudes of children. So even if he asks me to kill him, to sacrifice him, he will bring him back to life. That was his conclusion before he did it.
Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else can help me with the question, why is it necessary for us to go through suffering in order to share in his glory? Don, is it because we just wouldn't appreciate heaven without having some suffering on the way?
I just wanted to point out that evidence that our faith, God would do that, was based on evidence. How did the child come into being in the first place, Isaac?
Myra?
It was...
Jerry was first.
It was a miracle. I mean, what 90-year-old woman gets pregnant and has a child?
Yeah.
So faith isn't blind. It's based on evidence from previous experience.
Yeah, it's a little hard to explain why God would give your 90-year-old wife a baby and go through all of this, and now when he's just about the point where he can really do something, he asks you to kill him. That doesn't make too much sense, does it? Jerry?
Sharing in the sufferings of Christ would mean sharing in the purpose, same purpose. Mm-hmm. And if our view of the reason for Christ's death and his suffering is simply the forensic view of payment of a price, then we're left with an inadequate answer for our own sharing in his suffering. Doesn't really make sense. But if we can understand the larger purpose of Christ's death and the great controversy and the statement about who God is, then our sharing in that shares in that purpose.
Mm-hmm. As many of you are aware, a number of TV documentary type people, I'll be with you in just a second, Brian, have undertaken to go around the world and try to interview people who were somehow involved with Second World War, because obviously that generation is disappearing, okay? Many of us were on this geology trip with a man who was basically a very young man, almost a child, at the beginning of the war, and he was in the northern part of the Philippines. He was taken to Japan, the southern part of Japan, to work in the coal mines for the entire length of the war. You know, and so people are going around, they're interviewing these kind of people and saying, you know, we want to document this, we want it on tape, we want to know what happened, how do you remember it, all this kind of stuff. Does looking back, I mean, war is an awful situation. I mean, what positive thing can you say about war? But I would remind you that the greatest war of all time involves every one of us. We're in the middle of it. It's going on right in here. It's going. Now, if we think that that war happens while we're, you know, wearing our comfortable clothes and we're eating our lovely food and we're sitting in an air-conditioned room at Loma Linda University and everybody's looking up to us because of our high levels of education, if we think that's all that's involved in this war, we better think again. There's something more going on, and I, unfortunately, I have to say, based on the reading that I've done, that the reason we don't see more of the horrors of war, if you will, in the great controversy, is we would fall apart. Too many people would abandon the church. Now, at some point, that's going to have to come. And it's not going to be easy. It's going to be a challenge. And only the people who have fortified their minds, if you remember Great Controversy, page, what, I think it's 593, only those who have fortified their minds with the truths of the Scriptures will stand to the last great conflict. So maybe we shouldn't pray for the testing. Maybe we shouldn't pray for the hard times. But they're coming. And we need to be ready. Okay, you've got about 30 seconds.
Okay, I have a friend that told me that, because I had a lot of books, you know, all the Ellen G. White books, the volumes and everything. I had many more books that I collected. But she told me that, you know, she says, you should get rid of all these books because pretty soon they're going to take them away from us.
Okay,
and so that it was, it's like a burden, you know, carrying all these books around, especially now that I'm moving, you know, I have given half of them away, and I've still got more, you know, and then I keep buying more sometimes.
Well, I have a suggestion for you. You can get the whole collection on a little disc now.
Yeah? Do you think that's a good idea, what she said, though?
Well, I my wife tells me that whenever any visitors come to our house, she closes the door to my office because it looks so bad. And the reason it looks so bad is it's just chock-a-block full of books. Books are on the floor. Books are on every wall. So maybe you're not the right. I'm not the right person to ask. Well, anyway, we need to.
Is there anybody here that can give me a suggestion?
Okay, Brian, we really have gone over our time, so let's pray. Our kind and loving Father, although we know that difficult times are coming, and we fear them, we dread them, we will not give up our belief that you are guiding us. We know that the devil will do everything possible to discourage us, to turn us back, to help us, to get us to loosen our grasp on your hand. But we believe that these times are for our strengthening, for purifying our character. We believe they're necessary that we may enter your kingdom, and so may it be, as our prayer in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you all for coming.